This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It's Wednesday. It can only mean one thing. Between 10 and 11 o'clock, we are in conversation with yet another political party, a journey that we have been traveling together since May this year. And we have, you know, let you get to know a number of political parties, ask them tough questions, get to know what they stand for, who they are, what they are all about. And now it seems as if the tempo is getting higher and higher because we are, what, almost 5 weeks now to the election date, if I'm not mistaken. So I can only mean one thing. We are running out of time to do this business of getting to know other political parties and making sure that we know what it is that they stand for. This morning, we'll bring you the good party. I wonder if they'll give us a good life. They are going with the slogan this time around in their manifesto, the plan to make your hood good. I've got the Secretary General with me.
It's gonna be that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be.
Is it a good night?
Well done.
You are so charmed. You are so charmed.
Yeah, I am actually. I mean, that was very clever. But it's not just the night, but the day and the night.
The day and the night. Brett Heron is the Secretary General of the Good Party. Good morning and welcome to Power Talk.
Good morning, Lekona. Thanks so much.
Only a pleasure. Brett, you are no longer just the new kids on the block anymore. You've been in existence for a few years now. You've had time to appreciate the landscape of our politics, but more importantly, the landscape of our communities. Just tell us briefly, though, Brett, what the Good Party is all about before we probably start unpacking some of the individual items that are entailed in your manifesto.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, look, I mean, we are still relatively the new kids on the block, having been registered as a political party in February 2019. So we're 2.5 years old. But I think, you know, the party is led by people with lots of experience in government. So we bring, although we're a new party, we bring a lot of experience. Our party was formed really on the basis of four pillars that we want to achieve: spatial justice, which is really about addressing the spatial legacies of apartheid, apartheid's planning, which keeps many communities segregated, but which has other socioeconomic impacts. We want to achieve economic justice, where we address poverty, joblessness, and economic growth that creates jobs. We want to address social justice, which is about equitable treatment of all South Africans and making sure that people are able to live the dignified life that they really dreamt of. And then we address environmental justice, which starts from the premise that climate change is real. Towns and cities have a major role to play in reducing carbon emissions and tackling climate change. So those are the four principles that guide our manifesto and our campaign.
Perhaps, Brett, before we get to that as your program of action that is proposed, I mean, you are a grouping of people that come from different political persuasions, if I were to put it that way, at least in your historical involvement. You know, I took some time to look at your senior leaders, such as the leader, yourself, chairperson, organizer, deputy secretary, treasurer general. I mean, some of you come from the private sector, others from some different traditions of political thought. How do you navigate those to create a unique political, perhaps ideological leaning, if there is a need for that? Or you can simply tell me and say, well, what matters at the moment is that we have a viable program of action and not necessarily being stuck in sorting out what ideology influences us.
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. I mean, what brings us together and what is important in any political party is to have a cohesive and coherent vision and policy program that everybody is on board with. So with the old parties, you see that within those parties, there is conflict around what are the priorities, what do we mean, what do we stand for. So we're quite fortunate, when we formed the Good Party, the leader, Patricia de Lille, said, when good people do nothing, evil prospers. And that really attracted people from various backgrounds to join us and to buy into this vision that we're selling to or trying to sell to voters and to South Africans, that that there is an alternative. And so, yes, people have joined us from different backgrounds and different political parties, but they have bought into this idea that we will champion good policies under those four justice banners, and that if we are to identify in any ideology, we would identify as social democrats, mm-hmm. and that is set out in our party's constitution.
Now, perhaps, Brett, let's come back to your manifesto. You have now launched this manifesto. Maybe before we get there, just give us a sense, where are you standing? That is always an important question for our listeners to say, well, as we are having this conversation, if they are convinced, are they going to see you in a ballot paper, or you are not in their locality? So give us a sense, Brett, where have you fielded candidates?
Yeah, so we've registered about 960 ward councillor candidates in 45 municipalities in five provinces. So we started this process in about January 2020 when we appointed some political consultants who advised us where we are likely to get seats, where there are likely to be coalition governments or governments without no party achieving a majority. So where we could be part of a government or actually lead a government. So we are not like in 2019 where we try to campaign everywhere.
Yeah.
We've narrowed it down to 45 municipalities. So that's the whole of the Western Cape, the two metros in the Eastern Cape, so Nelson Mandela Bay, Buffalo City, plus three or four local towns, about five towns in the Northern Cape, including Sol Plaatje, which is Kimberley, Etiquette, Durban, and the Johannesburg and Tshwane in Gauteng.
Perhaps, Brett, do you maybe think it might be a good idea also to have it on your website, just in case people, want to understand where you are standing, and as they visit and interact with your website, it be available?
Yeah, that's a very good idea. It may be on our website, but I'll have to check.
I've also tried to see, but I wasn't lucky. But, I mean, it just might be there, and I haven't seen it. Now, Brett, let's talk about spatial justice first, because this is something that was important even when you were at your other political home. You used to raise these issues, especially about the city of Cape Town. But these questions around spatial justice are not confined to the city of Cape Town. They might be more pronounced in certain areas of the city of Cape Town. But we see them here in the city of Johannesburg, the divide between Sandton and Alex, and how you think around questions of spatial justice. What are some of the things that you believe as the Good Party must be done for us to shift? Because it seems as if it's becoming an almost impossible task to re-engineer the spatial construction of colonialism and apartheid.
Yeah, so you're correct that it's an issue that we've driven for a long time, and I have certainly been raising it for a long time, even within my previous party. And I tried to address it in the previous party when I had the executive authority to do so as a member of the mayoral committee responsible for transport and urban development. So it is really one of the founding principles that brought good people together was spatial injustice and lack of spatial transformation in towns and cities across South Africa. But obviously, many of us have experienced it in Cape Town. And I don't believe it's impossible to start addressing it. It's just been a failure of and a failure of political will to do so over the past almost 30 years since, the Group Areas Act, for example, was rescinded in 1991. And so we've had 30 years to address this challenge. And we've had parties in government for almost 30 years and Cape Town 15 years, and they haven't addressed it. The starting point must be to address, to use public land So land that is in the custody of cities and towns, that is well located, and to leverage that land for a public purpose like affordable housing and to address spatial integration. That must be the starting point. We have land that is available in areas that were maybe declared white areas under Group Areas Act or close to CBDs like the Cape Town City Centre and some of our other secondary CBDs. We have public land there, and that land can be used to develop affordable housing and start the process of integration. But spatial justice is also about the conditions that people are living in where they're currently living. And there's a huge disparity in the quality of infrastructure, roads, play parks, libraries, town halls in a different neighborhood. So it's a twofold approach. Let's have one standard of infrastructure in our cities and towns and make sure that those communities who have infrastructure that doesn't meet that standard, they get the upgrades while we maintain that standard in the communities that that meet the standard already. And we use public land to bring people into areas that they were previously excluded from.
Now, I mean, other areas, you know, where people are trying to be creative, Brett, is also perhaps considering bylaws for developers going forward. And some developers have tried to experiment this on their own without being compelled at all by the cities, where you think of dividing a development into different categories, depending accommodating people of a different socioeconomic profile. So where you sell units to high income earners at the market value, but then you give some subsidies to first entrant buyers into the property market and so on. What are some of the things you have as ideas there? Because it's starting to seem as though the property market itself is on a runaway train and developers are seemingly having too much power and say in influencing the future of our residences in different areas.
Yeah, so I think that's a good question, and it is. In fact, it's something that I did my final assignment for my master's in cities. I did a master's in cities degree at the LSE. And it was the topic of my final assignment. The starting point, there are two things that we would do. We would conclude a mandatory inclusionary housing policy. Mm-hmm. Now, that inclusionary housing policy is premised on the basis that all urban, all property in South Africa have development rights already. But in areas where property values are high, developers seek additional development rights because they want to get best value out of the land in high-value areas. So there's an opportunity where developers apply for additional development rights. Those development rights, in my mind, belong to the public. And so in return for those additional development rights, there should be a mandatory contribution to affordable housing, either on the site or off the site on a nearby vacant site, or a financial contribution to affordable housing, which will be used in that precinct. So the additional development rights that you're talking about, which developers right now are getting basically for nothing, but making massive profits on, should be shared. So it's really, and some people would call it land value capture. I prefer land value sharing. Mm-hmm. Those development rights belong to the public. The reason why an area is a piece of land has got more value, and so developers are incentivized to apply for additional development rights, is because of public investment in that community, and therefore the community should share in the windfall.
Yeah.
So yes, we would bring an inclusionary housing policy into being as a mandatory policy. And when I was in the city, I already had the document ready to go out to public participation. So the work has been done in the city of Cape Town, and we can apply it in every town and city. The second thing is, as I was talking about earlier, using public land. If you release public land to developers for the purposes of ensuring integration and mixed income development, you can release it with conditions that a certain percentage of this land or a certain number of units on this land must be social housing, a certain number must be affordable units, and you developer can make your money to cross-subsidize that off the market-related portion. So then you start integrating people on a site using the fact that you own the land and you are releasing it to the market attaching conditions to it.
Some interesting thoughts there. Brett, please stay on the line for me. I want to pay some bills and come back to you. People of Power, we are in conversation with the Good Party. Secretary General joining us, Brett Heron. You can put some questions to him on 0861-987-000 this morning as we are trying to learn much more. What are they about? What is it that they are offering? Which are the important touch points? He just gave us those four pillars that they believe justice must be achieved in our country.
Power Talk with Lukhona Mluli, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
We are in conversation with the Good Party, 0861-987-000. If you want to find out more from them, of course, you can also tweet me at Lukhona Mluli, hashtag Power Talk. I'll put your questions through to my guest. Brett, one of the most devastating effects of COVID-19 has been the loss of jobs, which has materially affected the economy. However, some people have attempted to go into the informal economy. It seems as though the various bylaws that are operational are more inhibitive than they are encouraging of people to participate in the informal economy. We see people being harassed, we see people being confiscated goods for, and then they can only release them if they pay fines that are very much more than the goods that have been confiscated. What, as the Good Party, are you thinking about insofar as, you know, insulating the informal economy from harassment, but also making sure that there's ease of participation for people?
Yeah, so I think the loss of jobs, the entry into informal economy by some people is really one of the top priorities that South African cities and towns need to grapple with. And, you know, we can't just have cities that talk about reducing red tape or doing ease of business without actually walking the talk or making it happen. And we have seen, and I saw it during the COVID pandemic, when it took the city of Cape Town 6 weeks to reconfigure its permitting system to allow informal traders to trade after the Minister of COGTA changed her regulations right in the beginning. They shut down on informal trading, and then she had a change of mind and changed the regulations. It took the city six to eight weeks to put those regulations into effect. And some cities did nothing. But I mean, the point is that we have to support the entire range of the economy, including the informal economy. And we have to also provide facilities, dedicated facilities for informal businesses to trade from. And there are many informal businesses that are trading from, you know, from people's homes, from garages, etc., where they don't actually have the space to trade. So it is creating an environment that allows people to trade, because we know that that is what is putting food on people's tables and bringing income into their homes. Creating the dedicated facilities for the small trader, like the electrician or the plumber or the panel beater, who just needs some space that is not in conflict with building regulations to do or conduct their business, and not criminalizing informal trading where it's trading on the side of the road, etc. So we need a completely different approach in how we approach the informal economy and not treat it as a unlawful or irregular business sector. It is actually a huge part of our economy, and it is keeping millions of families in South Africa. It is keeping them in food security and with some income. So we would certainly encourage support for informal traders to trade. But also provide facilities for informal trading or small micro enterprises to actually trade from.
Brett, let's stay on the line, please. I've got Power News headlines coming up, but after that, I will allow you to expand a bit more as well on other aspects of economic justice as we go into these elections and why it is so important for people. In fact, I had somebody call in earlier this morning saying, but will we have an economy after we are done with elections? I said, well, there is a connection between the elections and the economy, and you guys talk about economic justice in your manifesto. We'll find out more with the Good Party after Power News headlines.
9 a.m. to noon. This is Power Talk on Power 98.7.
24 minutes to the hour, 11 o'clock. We still are in conversation with the Good Party. They launched their manifesto a while ago, and we're just trying to get to know, you know, what is it that they bring to the table? What is it that is on offer? Yes, they were there in 2019, but those were national and provincial elections, and, you know, they might have ridden on the stardom of Aunt Pat, who knows? But this time around, they are actually going to the communities, giving offers that to a large extent must be tailor-made to the challenges that communities are facing. The line is 0861-987-000 if you want to join in on the conversation with Brett Heron, Secretary General of Good. Brett, before news headlines, I said I'd allow you, you know, give us other touch points in terms of your offering under that economic justice pillar. And I'm asking this on the backdrop that we saw in the Northwest, for example, Clover saying that they're shutting down and moving to KwaZulu-Natal. And the concerns that they were raising largely just have to do with local government care for roads, water issues, and. So what else do you offer under the economic justice pillar?
So, I mean, the economic justice pillar is really focused on our greatest socioeconomic challenge in South Africa, which is poverty and unemployment, and obviously particularly youth unemployment, with almost half of young adults unemployed. And the Clover story is a story that can apply in almost any city or town in South Africa, including the city of Cape Town, which many businesses are regarding as closed for business because they're unable to get building plans approved, because there's a lack of sufficient bulk infrastructure, or because the public transport system has collapsed, or because the freight rail system has collapsed. So if we're going to address poverty and unemployment and have economic growth that includes employment or creating jobs, we need to address infrastructure for a start. So we need to create the infrastructure that will keep the Clovers of the world in those towns and cities, but also attract other businesses and industries that would invest in towns and cities. But also infrastructure, building infrastructure, repairing and maintaining existing infrastructure creates jobs directly. So when a city or town is investing in an infrastructure program, they are investing in a supply chain that is quite powerful in terms of the numbers. So for every one job on a construction site, developing infrastructure, repairing infrastructure, seven are created in the supply chain, from planning through to providing the materials. All those businesses benefit. So we need to shift focus, address the inadequate infrastructure in our towns and cities, and in the process, create an environment that businesses want to stay in or invest in, but also in the process directly create jobs for the millions of unemployed people in South Africa, particularly young people.
Brett, it's amazing that you touch on that. In fact, I think Stephen is on the line with a question that is related to this issue of unlocking the economy. Let's welcome Stephen on 0861-987-000. Good morning and welcome to Power Talk.
Good morning, Lukwana. I've got a very short question. I wanted actually to find out from the Secretary General, what are their plans regarding agricultural in broader sense, of agricultural sector in broader senses, particularly meaning that this is the core of actually the lifting the people's lives, because without food, then we'll forever being relying on the outside world to supply us with food, which is the cause of so many things. I wanted to know, find out, do they have any plan or any program addressing that very same problem of land issue and how the people that had been affected by not being participating in agricultural, small emerging farmers, do they have anything in the pipeline to connect?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Stephen. Brett, I also want to put a rider on that question. Very, very important question around agriculture, especially if you're looking at the shelf price of food and certain things. Maybe also the touch on how you imagine things such as, you know, urban farming, especially in areas where land is scarce. But I'm glad you did your master's on cities. So at least around the world, there's enough evidence of what is being done in creative ways where different councils are trying to support as much urban farming as possible, turning rooftops into gardens, I mean, you know the story.
Yeah, so it's a good question because it really traverses all four of our justice pillars, the spatial, the social, the economic, and the environmental justice pillars. So there are two or three components to it. First of all, we support the land reform program, and we would like it fast-tracked so that emerging farmers can have access to land in order to participate in the agricultural sector, and we must use public land for that purpose, whether it's in the custody of the city, a provincial government, or the national government. Land must be made available for emerging farmers to be able to participate in the agricultural sector. In urban environments, we have to stop urban sprawl, which consumes land that is often being used for agricultural purposes, and protect urban agriculture that is already in place. Mm. So it's about the way that you design your spatial planning, which is to encourage inward growth in towns and cities by identifying in the right places, by making the agricultural areas protected areas from development, so you protect the urban agriculture, and you restrict the expansion of towns and cities, often through BNG or what used to be called RDP housing projects, which consume land on the peripheries of cities, which is often had been used for agricultural mm-hmm. purposes. So urban agriculture is and agriculture in general is key to food security in South Africa. It creates jobs and opportunities for income for those who participate in farming, whether they are small-scale urban farmers or emerging farmers or large-scale farmers. But we must protect the land that is used for agricultural purposes and encourage inward growth in terms of development so that we're not sprawling out and acquiring agricultural land, which often has low property price value, and then using it for public housing and building sprawling RDP, BNG, suburbs of poverty on land that used to be agricultural.
Brett, let's deal with something that I found quite interesting but possibly contentious in your manifesto. The idea of title deeds for residents in informal settlements, and of course I know there's a proviso there that if they are on serviced sites on public land, we've seen councils the country over evicting people who are occupying state land, municipal land in actual fact, and they say they're evicting them so that they can be able to put up human settlements. But of course, the lists that are there in terms of the needs registry might be different to the occupants that are there. Why do you think that it might be a wise approach to give title deeds to residents in informal settlements? Just also, as you might know, it's also contentious that some municipalities choose to service informal settlements that tomorrow might not be there. You end up spending about 3 billion rands putting electricity, but ideally you want to transition out of informal to formal residents.
So I think, the future of it, let's just start by saying, I mean, we can't talk about urbanization as a theory without planning for it. And urbanization by its very nature results in some informality because many people who move to towns and cities who are very brave and courageous to do so, to uproot your family and come to a town or city looking for a better life, whether it's because you want your children to have better education or you are hoping for a better job. So it takes a lot of courage, I think, to move from a rural area to an urban area hoping for a better future. But urbanization is a reality around the world, and we have to plan for it. Now, I mean, as I'm working on the ground meeting communities, there are informal settlements that have been in existence for 20 and 30 and 40 years. So some people are living their entire lives in informal settlements without having seen any benefit other than perhaps a shared toilet and a shared tap. But they can't themselves invest in infrastructure in that on that land because they don't own the land. So we have to identify those informal settlements which can be redeveloped into formal housing projects. We have to identify those people who are living in informal settlements who qualify for formal housing using the National Housing Program. But we also have to work with communities who would like to invest in their own environment by giving them the security of tenure that they're not going to be removed so that they can, you know, move from having built a shack to something more permanent. If you work with some of those communities, they have development visions for their own community, and let's, as government, give them the security of tenure so that they can actually achieve that development vision for their own community. But we can't have communities living 20, 30 years in an informal environment with no security over the over where they live, vulnerable to being evicted or relocated when there is no real alternative. So it is about giving communities security of tenure so that those that want it are able to invest in their own land and build their home in the way that they want to.
That's an interesting one, Brett. I mean, also, possibly let's go to your fourth pillar, environmental justice. You touch on the problems of water security. I mean, we've seen this talking about, we now talk about day zero, you know, in different municipalities, and we see how this the issues of drought affect even the agricultural sector that Stephen was raising issues around. I mean, it hasn't started raining in some provinces even now, and some farmers are starting to be worried that, you know, we're heading to October. We haven't really seen any signs that rain is coming. What needs to be done by various, you know, municipalities, especially now putting in mind district municipalities in rural areas, which are responsible for bulk water services, but may not necessarily have the conducive climate conditions?
So, I mean, water security is a massive risk and challenge for many South African towns and cities and South Africans living, you know, wherever they live. The climate, as I said earlier, climate change is real, and this is affecting rainfall patterns. And we used to rely on rainfall and the catchment of rainfall in dams as our water supply in South Africa. And rainfall is no longer as predictable as it was. As we saw in Cape Town, we came very close to having no water, and other parts of the country are also experiencing drought. So, I mean, when we talk about environmental justice and water security, we also have to talk about the role of governments, and including cities and towns, in the climate change, in mitigating and creating resilient environments in response to climate change, but also in looking at the infrastructure, the bulk infrastructure that exists. There's a lot of water that is lost through poorly maintained infrastructure, through leaks. Hundreds of millions of liters a year are lost throughout South Africa through poor infrastructure that is leaking. And if we go back to my earlier comment that infrastructure is the foundation of local government's responsibility. So we must maintain and correct the leaking and the wastage and the loss of water through poor infrastructure. But we also have to look at how we are, treating things like alien vegetation. Alien vegetation consumes massive amount of water, and often that alien vegetation in forests, etc., surrounds those dams that are storing water, sucking up hundreds of millions of liters of water a week.
Yeah.
and so we need to clear alien vegetation. Clearing alien vegetation is also a job creation project, and so the solutions are quite complex and quite interrelated.
Yeah.
But they involve fixing the infrastructure, changing our approach to climate change by reducing the impact of cities and towns on climate change, and by some simple practical measures, by clearing alien vegetation that is surrounding dams and catchment areas, consuming water that we could actually be using.
Brett, stay on the line for me. I've got to pay the bills just to make sure that my job security is still on here at Power 98.7. But after this short ad break, I want us to continue on this water security issues. You were in the city where things such as golf courses came up, at how much they are leasing land to from the city and so on. What is your thought process around those? And also just talk about other issues relating to municipal capacity. People of Power, 0861-987-000. 9 minutes to 11, which means Brett is almost on his way out. Do get in touch if you have a burning question.
Power 98.7, progressively elevating the conversation. Now, we're talking.
8 minutes to 11, my guest is Brett Heron, Secretary General of the Good Party. I see some of your tweets and I will get to them as well. Brett, golf estates, very contentious. Right here where I am, opposite the road, there's one here in Houghton, Killarney. You know, a lot has been said about how much water they consume, and some people are still looking for more, golf courses to be developed. What's your thinking around this?
So, I think it goes back to assessing the fair use of public land. Often these golf courses are owned by municipalities and leased to golf clubs, for very minimal rental, not related at all to the value of the land. In Cape Town in particular, we have far too many golf courses. We have golf courses right next door to each other, golf clubs next door to each other. And so we do need a rationalization of golf and estates or golf courses which consume water, which sterilize land that could be used for better purposes. So I think that we need to look at how many golf courses is a fair distribution to support sports and recreation, and how much of that land can be used for other purposes. And I think in Cape Town, and we did start this process when I was in government there, but I don't recall that the project ever landed to a conclusion. There was a study being done on the rationalization of golf courses in Cape Town, because there are too many and they do consume a lot of water. And part of the process was encouraging golf courses to merge, or golf clubs to merge with each other, so that the land could be used for other purposes.
Brett,
and I support that.
Yeah, I get you. Thank you so much for that response. Let me put a challenge to you that's coming through on Twitter from Entle. She says, I'm afraid no political party understands special planning. If they still put people where there is no infrastructure and allow people to put shacks on wetlands and river bends, not even good party can prevent that. What says you?
So that doesn't mean we don't understand spatial planning. I understand. I'm not a spatial planner, but I do understand the spatial logic that, well, I have a vision for the spatial logic of a city like Cape Town, where I'm the mayoral candidate. People putting shacks on wetlands and in stormwater retention ponds is a challenge for local government. But, when those areas are flooded and people start to move their shacks out of the water, which I've seen in Cape Town in the last few weeks, the city shouldn't go and now demolish that shack because it's been moved. People are not stupid. They don't stay in water as soon as they realize that they are in, they've erected a shack in a detention pond or in a floodplain. When they get wet in the winter in Cape Town when it rains, they move their shack. So then the city must stand back and allow that to happen, because people still need to live somewhere. If they're not living in a shack in an informal settlement, then they're going to be living on the streets. So the elements themselves and the environment themselves convey to people that they've settled in the wrong place. So it's not a spatial planning issue. It's actually just a practical issue of allowing people to reconfigure themselves in their informal settlements without saying, oh, you've moved your shack, let's demolish it because it's a new shack.
Brett, on a lighter note, what's with the gloves?
Why are you fighting? we're not fighting against anyone. We are fighting a good, clean fight for all of these things that are in our manifesto. So we're really fighting for change, for the justices that we want, the social justice, the environmental justice, the economic justice, and the spatial justice. So we put our gloves on. The gloves are not off, but if we have to take them off, we can do so.
Because I'm sure with those gloves, it can't be all hands on deck making service delivery happen.
No, the gloves are our fight to get elected, our fight to see these justices being implemented for all South Africans.
Yeah.
But obviously, when we're sitting at our desks, we work without the gloves.
Absolutely. I mean, the gloves are off. Tell us, I mean, Peter de Villiers, I was curious when you unveiled him as your mayoral candidate in Drakenstein. And I mean, what informed that? I've always known that he likes politics. Even his autobiography is politically incorrect, after all. Has he become politically correct now?
Well, I mean, he's from the moment we formed the Good Movement in 2019, he has expressed support for what we're trying to achieve. He's expressed support for the policy positions, for our leadership, for our movement. We have a newspaper. It's not a newsletter. It's a newspaper, and he writes a monthly column in it around the role of sport and recreation in developing communities and developing individuals in communities, especially impoverished communities. And I mean, he's demonstrated leadership in a different field, if you pardon the pun, on a different field. But he's definitely got the leadership capacity, the love for this country, and shares our vision that if good people stand back and don't get involved, that's when all the wrong people get involved and evil prospers. So he stepped forward as a good South African to lead, and we know that he's got leadership capacity and skills, and so we're going to use them.
And I suppose, I mean, Brett, talking about sport, we don't talk enough about this. Often we use sport just as a mechanism to get young people off the streets, young people off drugs and alcohol abuse, and I often say that's the exact logic that makes us not see the developmental agenda in sport and recreational activities where young people can unleash their talents. We've also seen, some municipalities letting go of parks, letting go of sports clubs. I can think of a sport club in Durban that the municipality has just left to become so derelict. How important is this in our thinking without just talking about the big, big issues? We've got 1 minute for that question.
Yeah, it's a really good question because every community should have recreational facilities like parks. The park should be decent with one standard, as I said earlier. If my child falls off a swing and lands on a rubber mat, there's no reason why a child in Delft on the Cape Flats should land on a concrete surface when they fall off the swing. So yes, parks, recreational facilities, but also in those recreational facilities, programs, so that young people are in a program and talent and skills and just fun and enjoyment can be realized. Those facilities go without saying, and without them, communities live with nothing to do, no hope, and no social or recreational outlet. So we must have facilities in every community, and there must be one standard for those facilities across all our towns and cities, and we must identify the talent from the programs we run in those facilities.
Brett, I know that it's going to be a very, very busy 5 weeks or so ahead. Wish you all the best of luck, but thank you so much for spending this morning with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
Absolute pleasure. Brett Heron, Secretary General of the Good Party, joining us this morning just to take us through their manifesto, their offering for these local government elections. Of course, we could have spent so much more time. The hour just really went by on us.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.